Well, welcome everybody to another installment of Crossing the Jordan with Joshua and Elijah. We have been off for a couple of weeks. Thank you, Eliyahu, for doing a reading last week and a little discussion about sacrifice. I listened to that while I was assembling a TV stand.
Oh, good use of time.
It was good because I was doing very delicate work, you know, with all the screws and figuring out which one, and listening to a very, you know, delicate discussion of the way in which sacrifice ties into creation and to the story of God's redemption all the way through. Like, that was probably the part I liked the most about it. So I do have a question, because there was a translation that I'm curious about. But before we get to that, we have an outstanding comment from 2 weeks ago.
Let's look.
All right. So this comment comes from Michael Purley, and he says, there were a couple of things that stood out to me when reading this text. Now, he's referring to Leviticus chapter 6, verses 8 through 13 in the English, that I didn't hear you address in your comments. In our English translation, it uses the term ashes in verses 10 and 11, but in Hebrew, the term deshen, verses 3 and 4 in Hebrew, refers to oil or fat. I think you've mentioned that in other lessons, Eliyahu. Is this just the fatness of the burning process, that is, the stuff that's left over in excess, which would render the ashes translation, or is the priest supposed to take the actual fat of the sacrifice as well and set it aside? It seems like some of this is getting lost in translation, and I understand why, because I'm not entirely certain what to do with it myself. And then he talks a little bit about the humbling aspect and all that. But we can address, I think, we did a little research. I think we can address the question on what exactly is being brought outside of the camp.
Yeah. Oil or fat. So I'm going to say a couple things. First thing, oil and fat are different. For those cultures who dealt with it more, it was much more of a really super important thing, not only for life sustenance, but for economics. Oil is, of course, there's so many olive trees around, it's usually olive oil. And fat is a different thing. So just like Eskimos have tons of words for snow, they differentiate. So I think they differentiate here between kinds of oil, fat, greasy, whatever. That's number one. The fatness of the burning process, which would render the ashes translation. So when Joshua and I talked about it, we kind of came up with this, that it really seemed, and we looked through all references to the word deshen, that's either ashes or fat, right? And it seemed to us that there is the fat that's on the altar, when it burns up, it doesn't burn up completely. It's not the same. The ashes have a greasy feel that you don't feel with a bone or anything else. And so that's probably, as far as we can make it out, the best use for the word deshen, the best meaning of the word deshen in Leviticus. Later on, it gets translated, like later on in the books, like Psalms, it gets translated more metaphorically, meaning fat, like fat of the land, goodness, richness, abundance, that kind of a thing. But here in verses, what turn out to be in Hebrew, so 10 and 11,
it's and 3 and 4 in Hebrew,
or 3 and 4 in Hebrew, right? So the priest gets dressed up in these cloth pants and lifts the deshen that is to be eaten. I think it says to be asher tochal ha'esh, that the flame or the fire will eat. And he lifts it up towards the altar, and he places it next to the altar. So it kind of seems to me like there's a pile of fat that kind of renders down because it's really hot next to the altar, but it's not burned up. And so I think that's what he takes, I guess, rendered fat is how I would translate it.
Yeah, and I agree. And I think Eliyahu's saying this, Michael, but this seems to be a word used with primary reference to meat, to animal, as opposed to plant, though there's one exception to that in Judges 9:9. There is this weird parable. Don't get me into the parable. I don't even want to think about that parable where an olive tree says that he produces a lot of deshin. I don't know what that's supposed to mean. But usually you'd use a different word, shemen, for that kind of oil, olive oil, things like that. So this is animal. And I was saying to Eliyahu, whenever you cook meat and the fat renders down, now if you're using a nice grill, the fat all falls onto the burner and gets, you never see it. But in a pan, if you fry something, you'll notice that all that fat turns into like lard. And we were doing a little bit of research about how this word is used. And there is a gentleman who interprets it as kind of the lardy remains, you know? So I think we can say pretty conclusively that they're not taking unrendered fat and carrying it out of the camp. It's been burned, and this is what remains.
Either burned or melted down and reduced.
Right. Yeah, so it's a good observation. But I do, I mean, I think Michael's comment kind of leads me to just make the general observation that there is a lot of focus on fat in not just Levitical law, but in the liturgies of Israel. Because you think, you know, olives are pressed and you get their shemen, it's a different word, but their oil, and that's used to anoint people. And I did notice in our research that there's a verb form, like if the word deshein is put into the PL, it actually can sometimes be used for anointing. So that's somewhat of an interesting cross use. So fat is interesting in the way it's used. God wants all this fat for himself. He doesn't want them ever to eat it, right? The fat belongs to the Lord. Right. And then even the fat of plants, like oils that come from plants, are used for sacred purposes. So I don't know if you want to think about that, Eliyahu, or make comment. I just want to say that with animals, in order to put on fat, they have to have a lot to eat. And so the amount of fat on an animal is also a pretty good gauge as to what kind of year that animal's had. If it's a very lean year, you're not going to have a lot of fat. So I imagine that given the amount of blessing that the people received in any given year, the priest would be carrying either a lot of fat ashes or a smaller amount of fat ashes. You know, yeah, you didn't like the fat ashes translation. That's actually in the BDB. But what do we say it should be?
Fatty ashes.
Fatty ashes, not to be confused with fatty acids.
Right. Totally.
So anyway, right. I do think that that emphasis on fat is this excess, what we get when we have more than we need. Yeah. And God makes a big deal of that, whether it's plants or whether it's animals. It's maybe also related to the milk and honey conversation. You're going to a land that's flowing with milk and honey. Well, to produce milk, animals need to have plenty of food. And to produce honey, there have to be plenty of crops and flowers for the bees to feed on. So all of this to me does seem important.
Yes. And not only that, by the way, with the milk and honey thing, but it's the word for milk is chalav. There, right? Eretz zavat chalav u'dvash, a land flowing with chalav and dvash, which is honey. Though actually, I've heard it explained that actually it's really date honey. It's not from bees, but whatever.
Point is really sweet stuff. That's interesting.
Yeah, but chalav, milk, is chalev, right? The same letters, just different vowels for fat.
For fat.
Yeah. So there is a point about abundance, and to me, it seems like, okay, God is really making a point. Like, I get the fat, I get the leftovers. Just remember that it's not all for you. I gave it to you. You give it back to me, and that's part of sacrifice, you know, or offering.
Yeah, and a reminder to not take more than we need. Because the fat is when your body or an animal's body, anything stores additional calories that it didn't need for basic metabolism and living. It's stored for later. And God wants those things stored for later given to him. It reminds me very much of Jesus' parable of the rich man who has a bumper crop one year and decides, I'm going to build bigger barns to store this thing. And then, of course, who was called a fool. Right. He was a fool. But that's the kind of like the body says, ooh, extra calories. I'm going to get big. You know, this is for future lean days. I'm ready. You know what I mean? My body loves to do that. My body's very efficient at building bigger barns if it wants to. But it's interesting that the Lord
stable with me.
Yeah. But it's interesting that the Lord wants that excess given to him, at least in terms of animals and things.
It's like, What do they say? There's you've never seen a hearse carrying a U-Haul.
Well, you know, unless you were an Egyptian.
Well, maybe that's part of the point. You know, God is saying, listen, get used to it. You can't take it with you. It all, when the animal's over, it goes to me. I mean, the good stuff, the extra, it all.
Yeah. And it's a test of bounty. It's all of that. Like I can imagine that during some of those years of famine, like the 3 years of famine that Elijah experienced under Ahab, I imagine that some of those sacrifices were pretty lean. I'm guessing the deshen was not as heavy as it was in the past.
Yeah, probably. So there's a reminder of where it comes from.
Right. Just like the tithe, right? You store your tithe in the storehouses. And then at the end of the year, you come and eat it at a festival at the tabernacle or the temple. In a good year, you're going to have a lot to eat. In a bad year, you're going to be looking around going, did anybody have a better year? I'm hungry. Yeah. So anyway, I think Michael is pointing out that these terms and what they mean in real life, not just abstractly, are figuring into maybe why the Lord wants certain things done with them. That's the thing I love about the Hebrew liturgies is that they're so down to earth. They're so rooted in actual reality. They're not just abstract like motions and, you know.
Yeah, it's almost not at all about your inner life. Right. You know, that's why Jesus was such a radical when he's like, no, actually, what's in your heart?
Yeah, because Jesus is sort of saying, yeah, you can do all these things without caring. But I do want you to care. You know, but yeah, you can do these things without caring, but still it's bound up. The animals put on fat over time. So it's amazing. And he wants the fattened calf. You know, he wants the cat that's been fed a bit. He doesn't want you bringing your starving calf, you know, the one you didn't give any food, you know, the one that you kept to yourself. He wants the one you spoiled. That's the one he wants, you know. So anyway, Deshen.
So did we answer his?
I think we covered everything except his final comment, which I don't have a lot more to say. I think it's more of an observation, but you tell me, Eliyahu. So, we've just talked about the milk fat kind of connection, but his final comment relates to the holy garments of the priest. It's mentioned in being in two parts. I'm guessing the coverings part is referring to that which hides the priest's unmentionable places. This will likely come up later in Leviticus, but I found it interesting that the details of the priestly garb are still mentioned here in passing. And we know that they're being mentioned when he's taking them off and putting on regular clothes to leave the tabernacle, right? All right, let's see. This verse 10, putting on his linen vestments after putting on his linen undergarments. So probably that is verse 3, I think.
Yeah. Absaron, yeah. Yeah, it doesn't use the word undergarments. It's just his vestments that are made of cloth and his cloth pants.
His pants.
That he wears against his flesh.
So undergarments is a pretty good translation, even though euphemistically anyway. What would you say? His boxer briefs?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what kind of stuff they wore back then. No clue. But something like that.
Yeah.
So that's the first one, but where's the next one?
Verse 11 is where it says he shall take off his vestments and put on other garments. That's the other mention of his clothing.
Yeah. I was thinking back to that thing that I read, not Leviticus, but the Jewish liturgy piece.
Right. Last week's episode. Yeah.
Yeah. Where they have, they're describing what the priest is doing very much step by step. And at one point when he has to go into the purifying bath, you know, to dunk, they hold a cloth to protect anyone from seeing.
Yeah.
So that's what I thought, but that's not what he's referring to. So
yeah, it is interesting that in a very quick passage where they're just basically saying you have to take off your priestly garments before you leave to take the ashes to the place that's designated outside the camp, that it does specify that there are two sets of garments he's going to remove. And that might just be practical. Like, don't forget to take your underwear off, you know, and put on other clothes. The underwear is holy as well. Maybe it's just practical, but there's also something that comes up that's routinely mentioned when it comes to the dressing of the priests. And you and I talked about this a little bit before we started recording, that there's a sense of modesty and decency and the covering of genitals that is highlighted in the priestly functions. You had mentioned to me when we were not on the air that he wasn't even allowed to climb steps so that the altar would see his unmentionables, as though he has to be modest even to the sacred instruments, not even just to the people. And that's interesting to me. Did you have more to say about that?
Just that that's in a different place.
It is, yeah.
But here it seems to me more like a reading of the proceedings of a Japanese tea ceremony, such that each piece is important. Every step is important. And its due mention is given.
Yeah.
Even though they probably skip a lot of things because it could.
They skip a ton. I think that's why Michael's pointed out they don't mention the breast piece. They don't mention any of that, but they do make specific mention that these two things should be removed.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it is interesting. And it's another reminder that the priests were layered.
Yep. Oh, very much so.
Yeah. And, you know, the question is, what is that layering for? And that's very hard. Later in Leviticus, we'll get into a much more extensive discussion of the garments. And maybe that's a better place to talk about why. But they are mentioned here.
Yeah, I have some thinking on it, but it's too conjectural. So I'm going to leave it off.
Yeah, Urim and Thummim. So I thank you all. So thank you, Michael, for those comments. I hope that that helped. It was interesting to us. We did a lot of research before so that we could figure out some of the bits and pieces, and that was helpful. I enjoyed it. So I'm glad for that. Thank you for that. And I just had a question for you, Eliyahu, and I know you'll just be spitballing this based on the reading last week, but there was one, I enjoyed it, and I'd never heard, I think I said to you, I said this offline, that I'd never really heard the liturgy read like that. You know, obviously the sacrifices tie all the way back to the beginning, and I never had heard Yom Kippur explained in such cosmic perspective, and I really enjoyed that. There was one translation that caught my attention that I went, oh, that's interesting. They said that God made us from clay. Now, the word in Hebrew in that beginning section of Genesis is afar, which we've talked about. And I remember you had a long conversation with me maybe a year ago, maybe two, about how afar refers to a very fine pulverized kind of dust. Mm. And because I had thought, I didn't look very closely, that we were made from Adama. And you said, oh, no, not Adama, afar. Yeah. And we talked about the difference between Adama and the earth and afar. And all that conversation, I was unprepared to translate it as clay. I've seen it translated as plaster, especially plaster dust. I've seen it translated as dust, sometimes even with reference to ashes, but never as clay. Do you have any thoughts about why they translated that clay?
Well, so I'm looking at it now, and it's a side-by-side translation And they translated it as clay, I'm going to guess, because of the metaphor of the potter's wheel, which is a metaphor that's used throughout Yom Kippur. There are a number of metaphors, you know, king and subject, master and slave.
So you're saying it's a reference to Jeremiah?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Or Yirmeyahu, right? Yirmeyahu.
Yirmeyahu, yeah, exactly. And I'm saying, I think they translated it that way because, that you know, to give that nuance. But in the Hebrew, it just ain't there. It doesn't even say clay. It says, it says chomer, which is just material or stuff.
Oh,
it's not specifically clay. I think chemar may be clay. If you can look up in your concordance, chet mem resh.
So that says cement, mortar, clay.
Yeah, so that's real specific, huh?
Chomer.
Yeah.
Mortar, cement for holding building stones together, clay as a material, vessels, and and they say used when God fashioned man. But I don't see it in Genesis, so it must be in another text that speaks about it. I bet you they're quoting another passage.
It's this, and I'll do comparisons, but let's just go with NASB. It says, then they said to one another, come, let us make bricks from the fire and fire them thoroughly. And they used brick for stone, and they used tar for mortar.
That's the word.
And in Hebrew, we have the hachemer hayalahem lechomer. So it's tar is chemer, and mortar is chomer. And so that's what they're claiming is clay. But the basic is of this. It's very, very fine earth, right? So clay is not like sandy soil. It's very, very, very fine.
I don't know if you've worked with clay. I wouldn't call it fine.
No. The little bits that make it up are very fine, even though you can have, you can have coarse clay. It's true. But the point is, you can also take ashes and make them into that kind of thing. If there's an agent that keeps them together, like the chalev, you know.
So check out this. This is Job 10:9. That says it all.
Yeah.
You fashion me like clay, and will you turn me to dust afar again?
Yeah.
That's got both of them together. So.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, I haven't done much work myself with like potter's clay, you know, and what it originally looks like. But I know that I had a yard that was predominantly clay. And I'll tell you, there was nothing fine about that. If I stepped in it, it would become like a concrete on my shoes and I would never get it off once it dried.
Sure.
And it was fine. Thick and sticky.
Yes,
and,
yes, it is. It is.
Yeah.
Fine. I'm opposing it to coarse. So sandy soil lets all the water through because there's a lot of space between the grains.
So would you say afar that afar is like that, like clay? When you first described afar to me, I thought of it like sand.
Oh, no.
Like very pulverized, powdery, the air catches it, it blows away.
Yeah, that's not like sand. It's finer than sand. Because you throw sand up and it basically comes down. You throw ashes up. There's afar. Remember, afar va'efer.
Yeah, yeah.
Dust and ashes.
Yeah.
So efer, it's you add water and it becomes clay.
But not adding wind, exactly. Which is what God did when he created us, is probably not the way. You'd want to add water.
I can't add spirit. It just... Not in my toolkit.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that. Like that's a useful exercise for me because I hadn't correlated clay with afar before. And I was happy to find this passage in Job where the two are related to each other. And so that's where they're getting that. That helps me.
Yeah. Yeah. And so where they said you prepared food and drink even before there was anyone to feast, you then formed man from, it should be Efer, right?
Right. I think in Genesis it is anyway.
Yeah. But so that's understood that everyone knows who's reading this, you know, I mean, who stays for this late service thing? You know, the people who don't know it, they've already gone home and pretended that they're not eating. But the people who, or they're tired or whatever, but you then formed man from clay, it says, but really in Hebrew, it says, bitavnit chotamecha, which is in the template of your stamp or your, literally your signet ring, you know, that thing yep. that's only you got that.
Right. Yeah. And your seal.
As the authority of the king on it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, so that's the image language, right?
Yeah.
And funny that that's the exact.
No, no, no. That's not image. That's clay.
Right. Right. But when you're talking about that seal or the signet ring, Mark, yeah. that is actually the phrase Hebrews uses in chapter one to describe who Jesus is, that he is, it says, I think it's usually translated the exact imprint of his being on the flesh of Jesus. But that word that's used there is usually used of a signet ring.
Uh-huh.
So it's as though God took his signet ring in the flesh of Jesus.
Yes.
Like that's kind of the picture, but it's similar to what is in that liturgy. Exactly.
So here it's not saying the flesh, it's saying chomer, which is, you know, translated as clay.
Clay or mortar or however in the world they translate it.
Right. Right. It's stuff.
Yeah. So cool. But thank you for providing that reading. I hope it was interesting to our listeners as well. Just getting the cosmic sense of Yom Kippur and the sacredness of it and the historicity of it. I loved hearing it. It was very soothing to me while I was building a very complicated and frustrating
TV stand
that nothing quite fit on. And it seems to me that there's an irony in that. That's the right time to be listening to the liturgy of Yom Kippur when nothing's working, right?
Yeah. And it's just, you know, the liturgy of Yom Kippur, it is that whole thing, you know, you read it and you get it, that people have that sense of there was perfection. We blew it. We need redemption. Is it going to happen? Is it not? And I got to say, that thing seems to still carry through to a discussion in Christianity of, listen, can you lose your salvation or can you not? That whole thing, it's like clearly here, all the Jews here understood, yeah, we lose our salvation, we lose it kind of right away. And hopefully God has enough patience until the next time, you know, as we do our sacrifices throughout the year. And then on the Holy of Holy Days, where the high priest goes into the Holy of Holies, you know, and hopefully his scarlet thread turns white because he's done the request.
Yeah.
The supplication.
Yeah. In the reading, there was a mention at some point. I don't know if it was an extemporaneous thing that you sort of just said, or if it was actually in the liturgy, that the sacrifice was for all sins, intentional and unintentional, which is interesting.
It's in the liturgy.
It's in the liturgy, which funny, you and I had a long discussion about Aidan Steinsaltz's conviction that is not, in fact, the truth, that it's only for Shegagah, it's only for unintentional sins. And we even talked about the fact that in the New Testament, I think the New Testament authors agreed with Steinsaltz, even though they were way before Steinsaltz. Maybe he agreed with them. But it's interesting that it's in the liturgy that it is for both. Funny enough, we're not there yet, and I know we'll talk about this when we get there. I don't see that liturgy as being accurate to the actual Levitical description of Yom Kippur when it comes to that point as to what the sacrifice is for. So that'll be an interesting conversation down the line.
We'll get there.
Yeah. So thank you, Michael, for those comments, which led us into... We came into this meeting going, yeah, we're going to get right into it. We're going to be real fast. And then we spent like 40 minutes researching this great question. But that's what we love, right?
Thank you, Michael.
Yeah, thank you. So, and join us tomorrow night where our discussion of Leviticus chapter 6 in the English verses 14 and following will be there. But thank you for joining us on our Wednesday response to comments.